SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
This is a podcast for the SBS Emerging Writers Competition. The SBS Emerging Writers Competition invites aspiring writers to share their unique stories, with the winner awarded $5,000 to support the development of their storytelling. Head to sbs.com.au/writers to find out more. Hello and welcome to The New Writers' Room, a podcast for emerging writers. My name is Caitlin Chang.
I'm Candice Chung. We're two commissioning editors at SBS Voices. We're here today to talk about all of the things that go into memoir writing.
Who you love or what you love is really defined by who you pay attention to.
So today we're looking at writing about desire and intimacy. Caitlin, we were going to dedicate this episode to sex and intimacy, weren't we?
We were.
But as soon as we said that, we realised we don't actually run that many stories that are explicitly about sex.
No, we keep it kind of PG-ish, I'd say.
Sexuality, yes, we write about, we publish, but very few stories that are actually full of steamy scenes.
Mm.
So sorry to pour cold water on the theme right from the start, but what we do want to talk about are the things that actually make sex interesting in the first place. So today we'll be looking at how to write about desire and intimacy, which are the key ingredients to every story about crushes, dating, obsessions, and lost loves, and very occasionally, happy relationships.
Yes, sometimes we cover those too. So I guess when you're writing about desire and intimacy, what we want and what we tell ourselves and each other about the things that we want can actually reveal so much about us, which is quite daunting. But how do we do this with vulnerability while also maintaining boundaries?
Mm.
How do we keep our writing composed while we also express really big, really private emotions? And how do we talk about desire without the fear of who is going to read it? You could write about your crush and then be thinking, oh my gosh, they're going to read it. And you might not want that to happen, but maybe you do. So, you know, there's a lot of things to consider when you're writing about these intimate thoughts.
Or like when your mom reads it, you know.
What if my mom reads this? Exactly. So with us today is award-winning writer Jessie Tu. Jessie is the author of the poetry collection You Should Have Told Me We Have Nothing Left, and her debut novel, A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing, which won a 2021 Australian Book Industry Award and was shortlisted for the Stella Prize. She is the emerging book critic at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald and a journalist at Women's Agenda.
Jessie wrote her first piece for SBS Voices in 2019. Her most recent story is a lovely meditation on debunking what good writing really looks like. Her refusal to pay more attention to the white male canon and dedicating herself instead to tell the stories of desire by rebels and outsiders.
Hi, Jessie, and welcome to the New Writers' Room.
Thanks for having me.
So before we start, I'm wondering if you could read out a passage from your latest story on Voices for us.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. I give my attention to those who live in bodies that is somehow othered, whose sexuality means they don't benefit from the heteronormative structures of our society, whose ambitions are outside of parenthood or marriage, whose ideologies don't comply with capitalism or racism or homophobia or transphobia. I pay attention to people who, on account of their rebellion, are deemed unpalatable. These people are infinitely more interesting and useful to learn from because they live in those blind spots we continue to teach our children to uphold.
I really love that. I guess the first thing I really want to ask you is, what interests you most about writing about private desires and intimacy, especially from a female perspective?
I think what interests me in that sense is that, well, I see that there's this sort of huge gaping hole when it comes to stories about female private desires. Mm. And there is a privacy that we have to, because there's like a huge lack of precedence in terms of what it is that a woman desires, because, you know, our history has been built on women actively suppressing or just destroying their own desires for, you know, the men in their lives, for the families that they create. And so I guess my interest lies always in the things that have not been talked about, or the things that have not been allowed the space to be publicly discussed, the things that are not, you know, commonly observed. And so I'm interested in whatever thing or object or concept that hasn't had a long history of interrogation.
Mm.
And female desire is something that is still relatively unexplored compared to like things like, you know, the male existential concepts. Just one example. So I think my desire comes from an interest which, like, from a place of needing to work out things that we haven't as women been historically allowed to examine publicly.
Mm, absolutely. Does it feel thrilling to go there?
I don't know if I would describe it as thrilling. It just feels necessary.
Mm. And
like everything that I always keep going back to my anger, like everything that I do, I think every day comes from a deep source of anger and like a healthy anger. Like I feel like the more I discuss my work publicly, the more I realize that a lot of people have seen anger, especially from a woman, as this kind of unhealthy, unsavory thing. And I guess like my anger is something that I hope will never diminish as I get older, because that's really why I do what I do, because I want to see the world change, you know, in the future.
Yeah. And sometimes that anger can be energizing, as you know, as you said. So I also wonder, to you, what does emotional intimacy look like on a page?
Being unafraid to look at your own thoughts and then kind of just slashing it out on the page. I think many of us use language to shield the truth. You know, I think a lot of starting writers, I know that myself in my 20s, when I wrote, I used a lot of words because I wasn't confident enough to say what it is that I really wanted to say.
Yeah.
But there, I think there's a real freedom in and liberation in actually allowing yourself to just say what you want to say in plain language on the page. And yeah. I think that best writers don't try and fool or trick its readers. Like emotional intimacy is almost like a diary, or like at least the appearance of a diary. I think some people are not even honest in their own journals. And that's a real shame. But emotional intimacy is something that takes, I think, a lot of time to cultivate. And it's hard to just sit with that, because we're taught in our daily lives to hide our emotions and our feelings.
That's really interesting that you say that about, you know, using, you used to kind of use more words and language to kind of cover up your feelings. And you can definitely see that in writers who do overwrite. You can tell that it's not necessarily an honest perspective, and often using like pared back language is, I think, a more honest version of a story, and you can convey so much more, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like when a young artist maybe trying to overuse too much color or texture on the palette.
Yeah.
Because they're compensating for their insecurities. Like I think all of us know, good readers, and I think we're all good readers in this room, we know that the best writers are ones that don't ever use any flowery language. Like for instance, I'm reading Deborah Levy, her third trilogy, like her third book of a trilogy about her life, called Real Estate. And like, there's literally not one word in there that I have to look up in the dictionary, but like, every single sentence of hers is like a revelation. It's just so beautiful. And you know that as you get older, that the most confident people, they never feel like they need to overhype anything. You know, when you meet them, they never need to be the ones who talk the most in a conversation at a dinner party. They just don't need to exert themselves. And that happens also on the page.
Yeah.
That's so funny, because it's about precision, isn't it? When you say fewer things, it's also about being precise. You're striking the exact right note.
Yeah, exactly.
Which of course also means thinking harder, which is, you know, it's a lot of work.
It's a hard thing to, I think it's a really hard thing to master, actually, like not overwriting.
Yeah. So in your SBS piece, you said all these Asian women are peripheral characters, only to be desired by white men who end up dead or neglected. What do you do with your own writing to actively transform that narrative?
I guess I try and just like, it's so weird when like you grow up with these stories, right? And then you put yourself, you kind of like look at yourself and the relative position that you have in terms of what you're consuming. And you're like, but I'm a full human being. Why am I not treated like with as much complexity and profundity as these male characters? It's so weird. It's like, what? Like, I'm also just as legitimate as everyone else. Cause you know, you guys live in female bodies. You would know it's like, I'm just as smart or just as clever or just as, you know, anything. Yeah. As these guys, dudes, and yet like we're always kind of just like not ever given a good, even not even given one good line in the stories. And it's just like, it's so weird. So I guess like from that confusion, I try and make myself, I kind of try and put someone who has like a similar face to mine into these narratives to subvert the narratives that we have historically grown up with. And treat myself as the most important character so that the generations coming after us, I wouldn't want like another young Asian woman to grow up feeling like she never has the same kind of agency that just normal white dude has.
Yeah. And I guess a lot of that is achieved by paying attention as well, which in your piece, I guess it's also what you were talking about, you know, what you choose to pay attention to, which is the female desire, the female body.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like recently, like maybe it's something to do with becoming like someone in your 30s, but like I really tried to figure out what it is, what really is love. Cause you know, we've had like centuries of male philosophers, white male philosophers try and like conceptualize this idea of love. But I'm still trying to figure out what love is. And I think at the moment, my working theory is that attention. When it's all about attention, like who you love or what you love is really defined by who you pay attention to.
Oh, it's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I think. And I just want to spend my life paying attention to those people who have not historically been given that attention.
I love it because what's more valuable, right? Our attention, like, is pretty much the ultimate thing that we can give to someone or something, which is really precious.
And
so what's the hardest thing for you when you are writing about subjects of our desire or crushes and things like that? Like, what's the toughest bit?
I think the most kind of uncomfortable part is kind of confronting my own shame about the amount of attention that I used to give to men.
Yeah,
and like
men
who just never paid any attention to me because like I wasn't a blonde woman who had like a desirable body. Like I've always felt a lot of shame and I think I still do from not being white and really feel like shame about that, you know, like I don't want to admit that because I really admire kind of people who don't live in white bodies who are like totally proud about the kind of marginalized bodies that they live in, because I haven't reached that point yet in my life. Like there are still moments where I feel shame and inadequacy of the fact that I'm not white. And that's hard to confront because I don't want to admit that, but I don't know why I do it. I guess I do it because I want to be honest with the world, because I've always found a lot of strength in hearing public figures talk about the most shameful parts of them. And so I guess in a way I would like to do that as well.
That's quite a, I guess, confronting thing for you to put in your writing as well, but perhaps a bit kind of cathartic and maybe a bit of a process.
Yeah, I'm trying to actually think about this because Larissa Pham recently wrote about how like in the past she was like kind of turning, you know how there's this kind of public theory that you should turn your grief somehow into art.
Yeah.
And she has this conflict like our pain or sorrow or grief or trauma shouldn't be aestheticized. And like, yeah, I'm still trying to think, yeah, maybe I shouldn't turn every grief in my history into something that's like beautiful, into a work of art, because that doesn't necessarily make the world a better place.
I guess it has the risk of it losing its meaning as well.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you are writing about desire and female desire, how, and, you know, love, how do you kind of, how do we stay away from the kind of cringy, I guess, sentimental territory.
Yeah, I find a lot of sentimentality comes off like the whole self-help books. Yeah. They often are like that, like Glennon Doyle kind of books. I just like, roll my eyes so much. Books like that.
So you're not saying like positive affirmations every morning when you get up?
No, God, no. I don't know how they do that. It just kind of like all those kind of books just always make me cringe because they're so they treat trauma and grief as this kind of one-dimensional thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, I think I avoid it because I just try and stay away from cliches.
Yeah.
And I think everyone knows, if you're a very observant person, which I think most writers are, mm-hmm. you know what a cliche sounds like.
Yeah.
So when you feel yourself slipping into a cliche, I just try and like delete it on the page.
Mm. Well, again, it's kind of about being quite vigilant and quite vigilant with yourself, your language, isn't it?
Yeah. Vigilant when you do the editing process.
Yes.
Yeah.
So write and go for your life and write.
Yeah.
But editing.
Then you've got to budget your words. I always find that, you know, when a phrase or a sentence isn't working and then it's always like, oh, I should delete this, but I don't know. I always feel like I don't want to. So I just often paste them into another Word doc that's sitting there.
Funny.
It's just like this little kind of repository for things that don't work, but I'll just leave them there. And
yeah, I think I do that too. I have like a document opened called Bits.
Scraps.
They might work at some point.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever opened back those Bits documents up, but it felt better at the time.
Yeah.
Because then you turn something from those scraps into something like even better.
So, Jesse, I know you're a fan of Garth Greenwell, who is a master at writing about sex and desire, and also without ever slipping into sentimental territory. Mm. What do you like most about his work, and who else do you look to for inspiration?
Yeah, I am. Like, if he was like a leader of a cult, I would follow him. He's so anti-cult. He's someone who just always is like, he teaches me to think for myself. He has this like amazing talk with Brendan Taylor about queer beatitudes. And it really is just like this sense that, like, I've listened to that talk literally 25 times.
I
wanted to be my religion. And my religion is like, he always says like, never fall into any one type of way of living or thinking or writing. Like, and he teaches me that living queerly through the world really means like being allergic to definition and not subscribing to any one concept of anything and allowing yourself to think and build your own idea of what it means to have a good life in this world or what it means to be a good writer, you know.
Mm.
But mostly why I love his writing is because his sentences are honestly like seeing something otherworldly. Like when I read his sentences, it feels like magic. It feels like the most amazing. It's kind of like the same thing I feel when I read the sentences of Deborah Levy. They're so simple and yet so like majestic and honest. I think that's what I love.
Yeah, and there's something about freshness as well. Like he's so good at casting a fresh eye on something that you wouldn't have thought about before.
Yeah,
which is really lovely. So I like that he also talks about desire in the way that, you know, he sees it as a form of communication, that sex and desire is part of telling about who we are.
Yeah, and because like he's gay and like he grew up in like I think rural Kentucky, I think, where like his body was so politicized.
Yes.
He wasn't allowed to express his desires in the way that hetero people can. So like so much about him letting go and doing what he wants to do with his flesh is so bound up in meaning that he gets to create himself.
Mm.
That is just such a, like for me, like I'm not a gay man, but I just something about that that really connects with me as an Asian woman. I don't really know what it is, but I guess it's just something I'm still trying to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot about agency as well, it sounds like.
Yeah, totally.
Mm.
Jesse, writing is, it's kind of a second career for you. You used to be a teacher. What pushed you to make the jump into writing as a career?
I would credit it to like one moment in 2016 when I was teaching at a Catholic boys' school in like the northern suburbs of Sydney. And yeah. I had these two white women colleagues who were extremely, like, they're now one of my best friends.
Yeah.
But they were like, they're in their 50s or 60s now.
Yeah.
But they always were supportive of my, because when I was a teacher, I never told anyone I was writing or I was a writer, because like it was just my private thing that I didn't want to announce to anyone. Yeah. And like teaching was a job I just went in and out of. Like I would go to school and then like not say anything about my personal life and come home. But these two women were interested in the world. And so therefore they were readers, right? They were active readers. And then through our conversations, I would share with them the fact that I was like a keen writer. Mm. And then they would actually just like be genuinely interested in me. And from that, like when someone takes interest in you, if you're someone who grew up like me with not having people interested in you, you suddenly feel like, hey, actually, I might actually mean something.
Yeah.
So like their interest in me and the way that they took interest in me made me legitimize myself, like made me think, I actually might be able to do something with my writing. That they were the ones, like it was one day in November at the end of the school term when they were like, they read a short story of mine and we were in like their storeroom, their art teachers.
Mm.
And they said to me, they looked me in the eye and they were very serious and solemn. Mm. They were like, Jessie, you know, you can actually do something with your life with this.
Wow. And
that conversation really changed it for me.
I love that. I love that. It's kind of, once again, going back to the attention thing, right?
Yeah.
It's like when someone takes interest in you or like, you know, what you do, it almost like a sense of dignifying what you're doing, giving it legitimacy.
Yeah.
And I know that you should be able to do that yourself, but sometimes it really doesn't make all the difference.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you do need those people outside of you to say, hey, what you're doing is important.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if like, you know, white male writers have that feeling of, no one wants to hear my voice, or if they I would love to have the confidence of someone, like, because I would be the same, I don't know if my stories are worth, I don't know if they're good enough, or, you know, I would love to just be able to like, yeah, you want to hear this. This is for you, you know.
I think that's where it starts, in, you know, very confident white guys' like heads. Yeah. They're like, everyone's waiting to hear this.
Yeah.
But I think the reason why they are so confident is because they literally, the world has so many, like there's an infinite abundance of stories that center them that they really like, they become 25 years old. And it's so normal for them to say, of course the world would be interested.
Yes.
Because every story that I've read in high school, we spent years studying, centered someone who looked like me. So of course my story is important.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. That's so true.
So I wonder if you could also share any tips with new writers who might want to become more open on the page.
I think the most useful thing that I've learned writing about intimate, private things is not judging yourself, like being able to just write whatever it is you want to write and then kind of say that is okay. Like it doesn't need to be like in your head. I think in writers' heads, they always have someone they aspire to be, you know, like I think a lot of people have James Baldwin or Shakespeare or Virginia Woolf or one of those canonical people like in their heads, and they always think, oh, well, my writing is not like theirs. I think the most powerful thing you can do as an emerging writer, for me, when I was still starting out as a writer, and I still do this today, is to just get rid of that comparison, is to just say, it doesn't matter. This is not Virginia Woolf. This is not Elizabeth Barrett Browning, but so what? Mm. Like, I don't have to aspire to be these people. I'm writing and this is good. And I think it's important to remember that, like, people like F. Scott Fitzgerald, he also had a lot of doubt.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure Shakespeare had a lot of doubt. Like, all our greatest writers had a lot of doubt. They didn't know that they were going to be the people who we now worship, you know? Yeah. So just giving yourself that compassion, saying, this is my truth and I'm going to decide this is what I think is good, and then kind of just letting go and letting the writing speak for itself that way.
That's great. So giving yourself permission to create.
Yeah, exactly. That's the most important step, I think, yeah.
That's amazing. Hopefully that inspires some people to enter the SBS Emerging Writers Competition, which is, you know, why we're chatting to you today and chatting to a number of writers, just to kind of give people the confidence just to put their story on the page and then see what happens. So thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
It's always a pleasure to chat, Jessie.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you so much, Jessie.
That's it for today's show. Next time, we will speak to community worker and writer Nadine Shamali about bringing characters to life.
In telling my story, I was also telling part of her story, but I was very much telling my perspective, which may not have been her perspective at all.
The New Writers Room is produced by Caitlin Chang and Candace Chung and edited and mixed by Jeremy Wilmot. Our executive producers are Natalie Hambley and Danielle Teutsch. You can find SBS Voices on Facebook or on Twitter. Entries for the SBS Emerging Writers Competition close on September 16th, and you can find out more by heading to sbs.com.au/writers. And if you'd like to pitch a story to SBS Voices, you can email voices@sbs.com.au.
The official anthology of the 2020 SBS Emerging Writers Competition is out now at all good bookshops. Roots, Home is Who We Are, published by Hardy Grant Books in partnership with SBS, features 30 of the best entries to inspire you to get writing.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.